All right, everybody, welcome here to show 145 on Crypto Voices. Matthew Majinskis, your host here from the cold Baltics, joined here by my friend and co-host Alec Harris from Halo Privacy on the eastern seaboard of the U.S. Alec, happy Friday. How are you, man?
Hey, guys. Are we doing weather? If we're doing weather, I'll just say it's unseasonably warm, but I refuse to give more information.
Good for you. We'll find out in a second how New York is doing, because our special guest today is from there. He is co-founder of the great new bar, as I understand, PubKey, co-founder of Hash Function, and formerly of Fidelity Digital Assets, Thomas Pakia from New York. Thomas, welcome. Thanks for joining. How are you?
Thank you very much for having me. Longtime fan of Crypto Voices. Very, very happy to be here.
too kind, my friend. Yeah, so we were just joking pre-show here. We could have done a family episode with all of our young children running around. Congratulations, and I imagine you're staying busy these days, running a bar till 5 a.m. and doing everything else you're doing with family life. So how's it going?
It's great. You might hear my two-year-old in the background screaming. She's been up since, I don't know, 5 a.m., no, to be clear, I don't close the bar. I would die. It's enough work as it is, but luckily we have like a really good team. It's been quite the experience. This is, you know, PubKey is my first, you know, adventure into hospitality. And I would say smashing Bitcoin together with a tavern has been a really rewarding, but just by far the hardest thing I've ever done. Like it's astounding how difficult the hospitality is. And then you're layering on top all the Bitcoin stuff, liquor license stuff. But it's good. We're going to keep it going. We're going to keep expanding it.
So what's the background there? How did it come about?
Yeah. Early COVID. I was reading some book that was like Revolutionary Wartime. I had, you know, my wife and I lived a couple blocks away from the bar that PubKey now sort of occupies the space in. I was reading this book, The Importance of like Alcohol and Pubs and Taverns Throughout, you know, History, particularly around, you know, paradigm shifts and revolutions and things like that. And what started as just sort of like a COVID, like, you know, we should buy a pig farm or like something like that, like one of those stupid ideas that you have when you're cooped up. Just ended up snowballing and one foot in front of the other. And we, you know, so as we started talking, my wife and I, and started talking to, you know, friends in Bitcoin and in the broader community, we realized there was a ton of support and excitement around the idea, and it just kept going. And now we got the bar. So, you know, the entire idea, it's a unique space. It's located in the West Village. It's basically on NYU's campus. It's got a long, you know, basement bar up front, but the back is a carriage house. And they used to have like pool tables and dartboards. Used to be sponsored by Camel cigarettes. There was like a Camel rep that would show up with like a fishbowl of loose cigarettes and just drop them off on like a weekly basis before the smoking ban in like 2003. So it's like a unique space. And I always sort of had the idea to put, you know, a live stream production studio for podcasts and content, and almost like a comedy club where you would have a live audience, but loop in the virtual community through, you know, whatever, Twitch, YouTube, whatever, but have it be mostly Bitcoin content, because, you know, the Bitcoin community, I think, gets a pretty bad rap for good reason on like Twitter and Reddit are just absolute shit shows and difficult to, you know, have a normal interaction with somebody. But at conferences, it was always very different, but conferences can be difficult as well. So just a normal neighborhood dive bar is the perfect place to have a lot of these difficult, you know, conversations that require way more of a human touch than, you know, just, you know, bludgeoning each other on Twitter.
First of all, let me jump in and do a quick shout out to all of our mutual friend Matt Tabak for linking us up for this. So thank you, Tayback. Second, we just figured out before the show that, you know, I thought I was attending our mutual friend B's birthday party at PubKey, and it was actually your birthday party as well. So happy belated, and you have an awesome spot there. And it is the quintessential, like, walk downstairs to get in, dive bar, you know, long, narrow, dimly lit, very homey, welcoming. So, you know, anyone who is, you know, even nearby, right, should veer over there and check it out. But I'm curious, right, before we get into like the Bitcoin side of the bar, was it hard to get a liquor license in New York? Is there like do you have to trade? Like, can you add more liquor licenses there, or is that kind of like a racket?
It is it's a difficult process. It's like, you know, there are a lot of layers to it. You got to go sort of get approval from the community board, which is very difficult in New York City, depending on the board. We had a lot of community buy-in, so we were fortunate. We did a lot of work with folks like, you know, all our neighbors. The block has had a really rough time through COVID. We're one block away from Washington Square Park, and there's been, you know, the neighborhood's going through, I think, still a little bit of a rough patch. So neighbors were very overwhelmingly enthusiastic about a business going in, particularly one that stays open late. You know, a lot of like college kids or, you know, young professionals fresh out of college. Like, the fact that the bar is open until 2 or 4 a.m. every night with security is, you know, a bright spot, which was, you know, previously specifically a pretty dodgy block in the West Village. So we had a lot of support. We got momentum there. And, you know, we were taking over from the previous bar. You know, shout out to a very good friend of mine, Marshall Mintz, who ran formerly Crows. He's been, you know, a huge source of, you know, support and advice. He's involved with the PubKey project, and really couldn't have done it without him. In many ways. But, you know, it was sort of one step at a time. And then you got the community board level, and then the New York State Liquor Authority it's a process. It's, you know, it's a highly regulated business in, you know, good ways. It's more complicated than it needs to be in other ways. But, you know, nothing's particularly easy in New York City, I would say.
Sounds right. So anyone who is in, so Washington Square Park is basically like the campus commons for NYU, even though it's, you know, just a city park. But anyone who saw that park during COVID would recognize that basically all the bars were shut down. And so they effectively moved every single kind of like campus social event became resident in Washington Square Park. And the police would just kind of hang out around the park. And there were like, you know, probably like 1,000 people, right, if you saw it. And that's since like dispersed back into the bars. So was getting like the party scene out of the park and kind of back into bars helpful to you guys and getting up and running?
So we opened up in October. We did like a soft open through like end of October, you know, through a decent part of November. We opened, I would say, in December. So yeah, those, that like crazy party scene in Washington Square Park, you know, had died down well before, you know, we were even, you know, ready to open. It still feels like it's hard. We have a small sample size. January and February, PubKey has seen really robust crowds, both from like Bitcoin community and just as like the neighborhood dive bar. But you can tell the city is still not like fully back to where it was from a hospitality perspective. You know, restaurants, bars, hotels, the ones that are open are doing okay. But a lot of stuff is just still closed. There's a lot of vacancies, and you can tell the, like, you know, the foot traffic isn't quite where it used to be. You know, we get a good crowd out of the graduate schools. So you're right. I think NYU owns every building around Washington Square Park is an NYU property in one way, shape, or form. So we get a lot of like grad school traffic. We don't get like undergrads yet, which is, I think, a positive thing in general. But yeah, the Washington Square Park like raves were pretty crazy. And I think they're starting to crack down around the fountain in the center. People would just post up with these tables and, you know, sell cannabis and whatever. I believe they're starting to crack down on that now to drive some of the business to, you know, places where they can collect taxes from, things like that. So it's an evolving scene at the park.
Yeah. The first time I saw it, kind of, I'm up there regularly. My sister-in-law lives very close by. And I was like, wow, that's quite the scene. But so let me ask you this then. Do people come in? Obviously, people are coming in because they're aware of it from like the Bitcoin community, but you must get just people coming in. They're like, oh, this looks like a bar. Let's check it out. Are they then surprised? They're like, oh, I didn't realize this was a Bitcoin bar. Like how essential is that to the identity versus like people just come in and to, you know, have a beer?
We get a lot of neighborhood. A lot of people just come in, like, don't know anything about Bitcoin. We also, from the beginning, we wanted to strike the right balance. Like, Bitcoin's not the bar's identity. It's more embedded in sort of the DNA. And we want to, you know, leverage Bitcoin. We want to use Bitcoin. We want to have it be a cultural center. But we also want other people to come in and not just get, like, you know, inundated with, you know, orange bees and honey badgers and have fun staying poor and things like that. So to have sort of that softer approach, I think, is really important. Since we enabled Bitcoin payments, one of the coolest things I've noticed is whenever somebody pays in Bitcoin, you'll have, you know, a couple bar stools, you know, three bar stools deep on either side of people just like peering over, like curious, like, what the hell is that? And having that start a conversation is, I think, just so much more effective, so much better than, you know, knocking on the door. have you met our Lord and Savior Satoshi? And trying that approach. So yeah, we get a lot of neighborhood. You know, it's really a true mix. Like, there's the Bitcoin stuff, and then there's just the fact that it's a normal West Village dive bar.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. So, you know, the last thing I'll say on the bar front is, when I was in college, I worked in a couple bars, and somehow I was a bouncer at one, even though, like, I wouldn't be a great bouncer today, but I definitely wasn't one at age 22. But like working, and this was like a very, like, you know, Boston Irish, you know, tradesman type of place, you know, come in at noon and leave. And Boston, the bars closed fairly early. But what surprised me was, like, so the sort of last hour into like getting people to leave, and then the state of the bar at the end of the night, as like an employee, when you know, see what that actually looks like, I was like, oh, this is this is some raw degeneracy. And so, you know, your bar seems like it attracts obviously only, you know, the finest of patrons, but was it an adjustment to like get into that hospitality groove and just kind of see the underbelly side?
There's so much that goes on for a bar, for a tavern, right? We have the kitchen, we have the bar, you know, getting all the product for the kitchen, for the bar, staffing, security, garbage. Like, you know, this is also an ancient building, so, you know, it's like taking care of a kid or, you know, elderly family member. There's a lot that goes on. So yeah, it was an eye opener. I play this, you know, my role is really sort of more on the Bitcoin, more on the content side. And you know, I'm almost, if you've seen the Rocky movie where he's older and he has to talk to the kid in finance, and he wears the red blazer at the Italian restaurant and goes around shaking hands, like, hey, how you doing? How's your mother? Like, that's more what I do. Which is fun. We haven't seen that rush, but I lived in Boston for 2 years when I was at Fidelity, like 2015 to 17. And one difference is, because bars stay open a little bit later in New York, there's not that like crazy last call rush where you put the, like, Boston bars will put the rat lights on like an hour before, and that rush for like last call just creates this like frenzy. There's a little bit more of like a soft, you know, close, I think, for a lot of New York bars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds right.
Out of all of the U.S., the New York bars stay open the latest, or at least there's no one regulation about how late they can stay open, right?
Yeah, we have a 4 a.m. license Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then it's 2 a.m. the rest. And even, like, you know, the 4 a.m. crowd is way down. You know, the city's really changed since COVID. So we don't get a ton. You know, after one, it really sort of turns into a service industry bar. Like, we get a lot of people from, there's a fancy restaurant down the block, Blue Hill, which is fantastic. So we'll get folks from there, and just in the neighborhood, hotels, you know, other bars that close early or restaurants. Which is very cool, because the camaraderie within the service industry is something extremely special. and cool to be a part of.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine.
It's very true.
And then when you bring in the Bitcoin content part of it, as you mentioned, you know, trying to get like that comedy club vibe, streaming, so on and so forth, how has that been progressing?
Great. Next week is going to be pretty crazy. So we are we're building into sort of every Monday having something. We have a monthly mining meetup, and we have our second one this coming Monday, February 13th. We already have, you know, more than 50 people. It's Drew Armstrong from Cathedra Mining and myself host it, and we have special guests. So the first one we had nice. Ed and Daniel, formerly of Brains. You know, the second one coming up, we have Amanda Fabiano and Brandon Bitcoin Beezy from Galaxy. We'll probably be talking a lot about ordinals. We do sort of like current events, state of the network, and then just general, you know, chit chat, gossip. But then we're going to layer on, like, there'll be a monthly Lightning one. There's going to be a monthly, it was previously called Shitcoin Chicanery. That's going to be myself and Arb Doubt, if you're familiar with Arb Doubt on Twitter, Arb Doe. We'll kind of dive into whatever scam or crypto shit show that's out there, sort of highlight differences between some of these other projects in Bitcoin. And, you know, regulatory, nice. Arts and culture, we're gonna have something on a weekly basis. But next week, Peter McCormick is in town, and he's hosting a couple of events. We're going to do Real Bedford on Tuesday. He's doing a live What Bitcoin Did on Thursday. It's going to be an interesting week.
That's great, man.
Nice.
That's really cool. Definitely. I used to be in New York a lot with my previous corporate finance life, a lot of investors I worked with, and yeah, not as much anymore. So unfortunately missed the timing there, but
how about a live regarding crypto voices?
Yes. Matthew, yeah. Just
I'm
go
sure,
online,
I'm sure
get
the,
a ticket.
I'm sure the clientele is screaming for that. They're just dying.
We are resuscitating New York City Bitcoin community. Like, you know, every day we're doing CPR on it. We got a tractor beam Bitcoiners to save New York.
That's awesome. No, I love the vibe and enthusiasm. And I actually didn't even know there was that much like kind of event driven stuff going on, which is, you know, it makes it even cooler. So kudos.
Yeah, we got a lot of other things. Like, this is a blank canvas for Bitcoiners. So we host the after party for BitDevs, you know, once a month. You know, they'll do the Socratic meetup, nice. And then everybody heads to PubKey. We're already getting a lot of inbound from, you know, people like, you know, I'm going to be there in June. I'm going to be there in July. Can we plan something? You know, PubKey also is sort of like a innovation lab, right? With the Bitcoin payments and other things that we want to do, you know, we want to start to use both monetary and non-monetary use cases of Bitcoin and Lightning in the bar so that people can actually see these things in practice in real life. And then we also took the floor above the bar, the parlor floor, and that's going to be a co-working space. So for folks that don't have, you know, a presence in New York, but if they're in town for fundraising or meetings or whatever, rather than running around and doing like coffee, breakfast, coffee, lunch, coffee, beer, dinner, all over the city, they can sort of use this as a base of operations. They can have office space upstairs and then hold court downstairs or have an event or whatever. You know, we'll see how it goes. But I think that this is something that Bitcoiners are excited about, and it's going to put, you know, much more of like a permanence and a human touch for the Bitcoin community to make new friends.
Yeah, nice. Definitely, man. Definitely. Do you think that this Bitcoin ordinals crazy block space debate is going to be something, you know, is it just a storm in a teapot, or is it something that, you know, is really going to be in vogue for a while to talk about and worry about in Bitcoin?
I think it's fantastic. I think it solves a couple of, you know, pretty big problems. So when I did like panels or anything that were mining related, I was like, you know, conferences for Bitcoin have been all Lightning or mining, or like a mix of the two. And there is sort of a inherent friction between the two, right? I think that with fees being so low and people getting, you know, incentivized or pushed to use, you know, layer two, in the absence of full blocks and robust fee markets, that's a problem. Like, the miners absolutely need the transaction fees now. This is something that has to increase over time as the block subsidy decreases. So base layer transaction fee market is, you know, I think a really important and underappreciated issue, particularly when we talk about the excitement of, you know, the developing capacity and blah, blah, blah of the Lightning Network. So I think that this solves that problem. You know, people can buy block space. I don't think it's, you know, a terribly well-aligned ethos with Bitcoin to say, you know, what people can and cannot do with block space that they pay for. But this also, I think, is going to help the Lightning Network as well. Like, as transaction fees get more expensive, that is a natural push for people to, you know, push some of the activity to the second layer and, you know, pick and choose their spots that they want to settle to the base chain.
Obviously, we've gone through the block size war and everything from, 2014, 2013, really, up until late 2017, and UASF kind of solved a lot of that, showed the miners weren't in control. But, I think it almost seems like every halving, basically every sort of Bitcoin cycle, you're going to have this sort of tension about what needs to be on the base chain and what doesn't need to be on the base chain. And I think, like you said, the important thing is that the economics of the mining fees work out. And as long as there's someone willing to pay that fee, there's definitely going to be a miner willing to accept it.
Yeah, for sure. And look, I mean, I think that Bitcoin is tremendously valuable, right? Like, the concept of settlement finality, you know, as it works in Bitcoin, is something that should be worth paying up for in a number of different respects. So I think, you know, high fees make a ton of sense, and it helps, you know, scale sort of the other, like, throughputs of layer two by pushing a lot of, you know, demand up there where it belongs. I think it's a net positive. There are concerns, there are issues with it, I'm sure, that we're going to have to deal with, you know, more sophisticated pruning, better filters at, like, you know, the node level. I think all that's fine. But I think the optionality in allowing people, you know, sort of their own discretion to use the tools that are available in the way that they want to is more of a Bitcoin forward approach.
Let's camp out on the ordinals a little, because it's, I would argue, it's probably the topic right now in Bitcoin. And so, you know, can you explain what it is? I think people are somewhat falsely saying, oh, it's just an NFT on Bitcoin, and it bears some similarity, but it has more finality and maybe a little less malleability of the programming. And so can you just, like, set the stage on what it is and why there's some controversy?
Sure. Admittedly, I am a little bit behind. This is pretty new. I've been distracted with other stuff. But, you know, effectively two upgrades enabled, you know, some extra space for more data to be embedded in a transaction. So we had SegWit, and then a subsequent upgrade with Taproot has allowed, I think, a maximum of about 4 megabytes. The interesting thing about inscriptions, yeah, and ordinals, not to use them interchangeably, they're a little bit different, but people generally do. You can embed if the NFT is like a JPEG or whatever, you can actually embed that itself into the chain, which is actually really interesting because, you know, the NFT platforms historically are a link effectively to another database. So, you know, Ether, Solana uses like Arweave or something. I forget what it is on Ethereum, but you know, the actual data itself, the picture, is embedded on the Bitcoin blockchain, whereas it's just a link to another database elsewhere, which brings up it's hysterical that Bitcoin figured this out, solved a security issue, and also does it in a better better way than the other chains. Like, just accidentally this happened. It's like too perfect. And then it also brings up a really interesting, you know, item around sort of settlement finality and this information, right? Embedding stuff, inscribing it, basically chiseling it in marble so that it's always there, creates look, very complicated discussions around this, right? Whether or not that's a good thing in certain cases, if it's, you know, pornographic material that's particularly, you know, problematic, if it's, you know, schematics or WikiLeaks or whatever, it's going to bring up a lot of, I would say, hard conversations. But I think the innovation is pretty clearly, you know, mind-blowing. It's a big deal.
Interesting. And what do you think the, so, you know, inscribing stuff that some might find objectionable, yeah, I get it. And that's, I mean, people have said that about Bitcoin blocks before. But what would you say is, so there's also the kind of like block size consumption debate that's going on. And do you have an opinion on that?
I think it's fine. I think that it's just going to, you know, boost the fee market. I think that, you know, Bitcoin transactions are valuable and they, you know, I don't really buy the spam argument, to be honest. If you're paying for something, I think by definition, it's not spam. And, you know, I think that this is just going to help push, as long as, look, if it starts to actually have a material effect on the technical throughput of the chain, that was one thing. But so far it hasn't. And these are legal transactions as far as the rules of the protocol go, right? And it has a fee attached. And if it means that an individual needs to spend more to process, you know, their layer one Bitcoin transaction, then I think that that's fine. Like, I'm not super up in arms about it. I understand, like, the Luke Dashes and the small blockers. Like, I totally get where that's coming from. But, you know, everybody agreed to this upgrade. Everybody agreed to SegWit and Taproot. So we kind of just got to deal with it.
Yeah, and I mean, people are gonna use it as they can, and sometimes it's unexpected. I mean, yeah, there has been some sketchy usage of putting data on the blockchain before, but I remember even, I don't know the details of this, but I believe even pre-SegWit, everybody's favorite economist from Bitmain, Jihan Wu, I think he put information on Tiananmen Square up on the Bitcoin blockchain, and that was like, you know, that's there forever that China can't take down. You know, I'm not sure it's going to be so sort of greenfield optimistic for this type of thing. It's hard to know if this is like a novelty, if it wear off or not, you know, on Bitcoin itself, on Bitcoin proper, if it's going to be like a sort of a needed feature. But I mean, you know, as long as it follows the rules of the protocol, it's hard to argue. And, you know, we'll see if we get on a Bitcoin standard and major entities, organizations, individuals are settling, you know, every 10 minutes. Just massive amounts of Bitcoin on chain, and there's lots and lots of usage and lots of fees. Maybe you won't see this as an issue anyway, for those that, you know, like you said, are hardcore small blockers and don't want these type of features on Bitcoin. So yeah, I think it's worked out so far in Bitcoin, and I don't necessarily see this as a problem like many do.
Yeah, this is not to say that I'm a believer of like the NFT projects that we've seen, like the profile pictures or any of the activity on like the, you know, Solana or like Ether projects. Like, I don't think that there's been, you know, real sustained like value creation through these projects. They're like largely hype driven. And I think that the Bitcoin stuff is going to go through the same cycle, and it's a lot of the same people. Right. Like you got like Udi and like, you know, other folks that were doing these things on the other chains. Now they're doing it on Bitcoin. So that'll run its course. But I do think that the core innovation of being able to embed, you know, some amount of data on the Bitcoin blockchain, have it sort of be warehoused there permanently, has, you know, massive potential and is super interesting. And we're also like, as far as the bandwidth concerns, right, and being able to run your own node, the difference is not that material, right? We're talking about, I think, max of 4 megabyte blocks. Like, you know, hardware space is pretty cheap. Like, you know, at some point it doesn't need to follow sort of the, you know, 1 megabyte, you know, 10 minutes anywhere in the world from 2009. Like, there can be like slow like progressions to match advances somewhere along the way, as long as it keeps, you know, the core principles of the protocol in place.
That's a good summary. So I wanted to pivot a little bit. We should have probably started here, but you know, you've been in the community for a long time. Can you kind of talk to your Bitcoin Genesis story and what brought you in?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a recovering lawyer. I was a swap and derivative lawyer. I went to law school in Kansas and in the Netherlands, actually. And I was on a flight November 2011 going back to school. I went to Maastricht University in the Netherlands. And I picked up a Wired magazine, and it was one of the first Bitcoin obituaries. I think it was the Andy Greenberg, November 2011. Bitcoin crashed from like $35 to like $3. Interesting technology, really interesting cast of characters. Tech is clearly dead. Let's do a retrospective. I read that article on the plane. My mind was blown. You know, by the time I, you know, looked at it again a couple days later, you know, bounced to like $5 or something like that. Clearly wasn't dead. And then it just was, you know, it was a mind worm from there on out. Practiced a little bit. I left, you know, in like 2013 to do Bitcoin sort of full time, whatever that meant at the time. There wasn't that much to do. Kind of bounced around with like nonprofits and small financial, you know, boutique type shops talking about Bitcoin, saying this is interesting. But then I went back to school. I got a master's in finance from NYU. I wrote a Bitcoin thesis on, you know, merchant adoption, you know, comparison to like, you know, credit debit card fees. The conclusion of that thesis is it didn't make a ton of sense as a payment rail for a number of reasons that I think, you know, we all sort of experienced. After that, and I helped them design their first cryptocurrency course, which is cross-listed from the law school and the business school. And occasionally I'll do a guest lecture on crypto derivatives at NYU.
Nice. How was your thesis received from your professors?
I think everybody was fascinated by it. And like a lot of the thesis was really just sort of explaining how Bitcoin worked, the mechanics, and then going into some of the fee market stuff and comparing against like credit card transaction fees, you know, the market price volatility risk, you know, settlement risk, all that stuff made it like not viable. But what I did was I ended up calling up like every single vendor I could find in New York City. Sometimes I would go in and interview them on the spot. Other times it was, you know, just email correspondence. I met some really interesting characters. This was like 2013, 2014. So you can imagine, you know, the folks that were accepting Bitcoin back then. It was well received. It was interesting. It was better than like a Thai bond analysis.
Oh, that's too right, man. I mean, I go through these balance sheets every quarter to do this monetary base stuff. And it's just like, it matters to those people that are in those parts of the world, I guess. But yeah.
From the professor's perspective, it's just like, you know, they were more intrigued with, you know, PersianRugs.com accepting Bitcoin than like the guy doing the Thai bond analysis.
You later went on to Fidelity, right?
Yeah, in between, I did a quick stop at Digital Asset Holdings, which was run by Blythe Masters. Originally, when I joined, it was a Bitcoin company, and they were mostly focused on like color coin financial service products and solutions. But then it very quickly, this was during the time where like the word Bitcoin was toxic in any like bank or financial institution. So it ran a very quick progression through like, you know, blockchain stuff to distributed ledger technology stuff. And then I would say irreconcilable differences manifested between me and the company, which led to my departure. And then I joined Fidelity as one of their first, you know, Bitcoin subject matter experts. It was the Bitcoin incubator at the time, housed within Fidelity Labs. That got renamed to the blockchain incubator during my time there. Sort of that progression has followed me through my journey. But I helped Fidelity with, you know, a number of their projects, the mining operation, Fidelity Charitable, and the early sort of schematics for what eventually became Fidelity Digital Asset Services. So the special purpose chartered trust, you know, Bitcoin custody and exchange. A lot of legal risk and compliance meetings I would say, you know, it was, you know, an interesting time to be there because there was just tremendous support from senior leadership, including Abby Johnson, the CEO. But getting the entire organization, you know, aligned on doing a Bitcoin was a challenge, right? A lot of people were very uncomfortable, even sort of like discussing Bitcoin. So I did a lot of Bitcoin 101s. I would go into some far-flung compliance executive's office with a paper wallet and $5 of Bitcoin and start from the beginning, like, you know, building a transaction, sending it. And I had a good conversion rate, but that got a little tiresome after a while. So I left in 2017, started HODL Capital, which is, you know, a private fund, you know, still in operation today, and mostly focused on Bitcoin mining and hash rate market developments and hash rate specific, you know, swap and derivative products. We're actually transitioning from HODL Capital to a new company called Hash Function, which I'm the co-founder of now, to really sort of warehouse all of that, you know, hash rate product development and, you know, private market investments for hash rate market infrastructure is going to go through that entity.
You have a lot of institutional experience. How was, did you ever have many interactions with Miss Masters?
Yes, I did. I think I was her first or second hire after she took over.
Wow.
The head of a digital asset. Extremely smart, extremely charismatic. She's, you know, she's great.
She's been controversial through the years in the derivatives market for, you know, a lot of people put a lot of blame on derivatives for the, you know, the financial crisis and so on and so forth. And then she was not necessarily, when she came in, pro Bitcoin, I think, at all. Like you said, that was blockchain DLT tech time, but I haven't followed lately. I don't know. I don't know if you have either, what she's up to.
I don't think she's there anymore. I think she joined a private equity shop. And yeah, you know, I think that she definitely understood Bitcoin. I don't think that she was pro Bitcoin or negative Bitcoin. I think for the direction of the company, there was a decision that was made that it wasn't going to be a Bitcoin company. It was going to be, you know, more distributed ledger focused, which, you know, may or may not have made sense. I don't know what they've done since. They raised a ton of money. So it clearly worked from a capital formation perspective. But, you know, she definitely gets it. Like, and, you know, her ex-husband, Danny, is, I'm blanking on the name, CoinShares. So, you know, there's definitely, you know, they have been in and around the space for a very long time.
This is maybe just personal curiosity, but here we go, world. Abigail Johnson gets a lot of credit, you know, being very early, especially in that, you know, Fortune 100 institutional space to make a strong play into Bitcoin. Was that really her? Like, did she have a personal, you know, push into that? Or did that just happen to happen in Fidelity and, you know, under her management?
I don't know exactly where, how she got hooked on it. She's definitely very enthusiastic about the project and, like, knows her stuff. You know, there was the incubator, and the incubator got a ton of support. I think that there were times where it was just like, might not get the funding to keep this going. And then it was just like, yep, keep going. Like, what else? You know, months of preparing for like a high anxiety meeting. And it's just like, could get shut down tomorrow. And then it's just like, no, like, keep everything pushing. I don't know where she initially found out about it. I had heard it was, you know, like her daughter or something was interested in it. And then she, you know, got hooked and was learning about it. But I could be completely wrong about that.
I've actually heard that story, not specific to her, but, you know, the, like, I think Chris Giancarlo, a former CFTC director and, you know, now like Bitcoin dad, right? His story was, you know, as a regulator, he heard about it, but then his kids, you know, swayed him to be a little more benevolent. So I'm sure there's plenty of that going on. And you have the whole like Tim Draper, Adam Draper thing going too. So, you know, kudos to the millennials bringing something to the table.
Yeah.
No offense to any millennials.
Take this seriously.
Better than Zoomers, right? So the HODL Capital, that's kind of your current, you know, business life, or what's keeping you busy right now?
Yeah, I think, you know, HODL Capital is being sort of crystallized. It's, you know, private fund, you know, three partners. You know, we never really went out to raise outside capital. We just sort of stuck to our knitting, a couple of private market investments, you know, mostly Bitcoin stuff. The initial thesis was actually, a special situations approach to finding either like technical or economic vulnerabilities in shitcoins that we could, you know, structure a trade around and, you know, use that as an accumulation, strategy for Bitcoin. And we had a couple of like, you know, decent, approaches early on, but like, look, opaque market, OTC, like getting a proper price on a short for a shitcoin that's technically broken. Like, you know, we still see Shiba and Doge and these things just go wild. So quickly identified that as a non-viable strategy for my health and the health of the fund. It was really like very straightforward, like very simple and boring. But in late 2018, early 2019, we started getting approached by a bunch of energy folks who had learned about the, you know, flare methane Bitcoin mining strategy, probably from Steve Barber. I think Barber was the first one that I heard about it from. I don't know if he identified that opportunity first, but I think it was him. And in having those conversations, that was my first real dive, you know, Bitcoin mining in the U.S. in particular was really sort of like, you know, a no-go zone for a lot of people. This was like, especially through the block size wars and everything, this is, you know, something that is a service provider, a utility, not that interesting. But by thinking about it through the lens of the energy industry and realizing the potential there, that was sort of mind-blowing for me. And then that opened up going down the mining rabbit hole, going down the energy rabbit hole, all these different use cases. And that really shifted the focus of HODL. I would say, you know, by early 2019 to mid 2019, that was like our primary focus and sort of has been ever since.
It seems like your model of, you know, more of a proprietary desk and just private sort of capital investing is certainly the best way to go right now. I mean, obviously, we don't need to go through everything that's happened in the last 3 months in Bitcoin and crypto land, but it's not looking too good for institutional and retail investors. What do you think about the latest round? I mean, this is like, you know, dime a dozen, par for the course in Bitcoin, right? But I mean, we got Kraken just got hit with a $30 million fine, had to shutter their staking operations in the U.S. SEC is not backing down. Obviously, we'll see what happens with Genesis and Gemini. I mean, Genesis is obviously declared bankruptcy, but I mean, it's pretty tough out there. What do you think is going to happen in Bitcoin land in the next few months from the regulation side?
Very complicated question.
Or do you have an opinion? Yeah. Do you have an opinion on it? Do you care about it?
Yeah, no, I do. Look, it's important. I'm just trying to think of how I want to approach it because it's like my head is spinning. There's a lot of different ways that you can approach it. So I'm not a Bitcoiner that's cheering for the SEC to like do a regulation.
Yeah. You can't. You definitely can't do that. I agree.
Yeah.
Plenty of Bitcoiners do, but I don't understand it.
Yeah, I really don't get it. But I will say that, like, you know, it is the basic job of the SEC to protect, you know, consumer retail investors. These are clearly securities, and it's wild that it's been allowed to go on for so long. Like when Ethereum first sort of launched their ICO, this was a security offering. It continues to operate as a security. All ICOs are a security. And if we were to rewind and say, okay, what could the SEC have done in 2016, 2017, there were really only three options. They could play whack-a-mole with the most egregious ICOs. They could choke off the exchanges, or they could go after Ethereum itself and have like a real, you know, seminal case to, you know, establish if there are going to be new rules or if they are going to simply follow the framework that has evolved in, you know, our common law system over hundreds of years. And they played whack-a-mole. They did the path of least resistance. They didn't want to have a big fight with Ethereum or the exchanges. And I think it was the worst possible option they could have chose. We have all this confusion. We have customers getting absolutely wrecked and rugged left and right. And it's just a complete failure. And it's sort of sad to see. I think I agree with Nick Carter. I think that this is going to be a choke point situation. They're going to go after the exchanges more and more. I still think that Bitcoin is, you know, the most resilient and can chart a course through this, but it's not going to be smooth sailing, I think, for anything tangential to the industry. You know, I would expect them to ramp up some of the scrutiny on mining operations and all types of exchanges. You know, I think custodians are safe because that's just a box. I don't know if that answered your question. I'm happy to go. Look, I love this shit. My wife and friends are tired of hearing me talk about this stuff. So I'll talk about whatever you find interesting.
So, well, let me add a little to this. This is a loaded question, right? But so we know that the regulators of all ilks, not just in the U.S., have had their sights set on crypto for a while. And we've seen, you know, as you described, right, like some attempts here and there. But then crypto brought a bunch of negative attention on itself, clearly, right? We had a ton of charlatans and bad actors, and they collaborated and conspired and fought each other. And the attention's been horrible. And it created the perfect environment, you know, in terms of like narrative and public sentiment to come in and, you know, really get aggressive on the regulator part. And I would say it was almost demand to do it, not just the environment for it. And so how much of this is going to be a self-inflicted wound?
Yeah, it's really hard to say, because I think that there was some legal basis for some really poorly thought out business models, like leverage kills. And the BlockFi stuff, you know, and in a different way, the Celsius stuff, Genesis's role in, you know, offering just gigantic uncollateralized or undercollateralized loans. Like, yeah, I think that there's a self-inflicted gunshot wound here for sure. What it ends up affecting is going to be really interesting, right? Like, should this have a material effect specific to the price of Bitcoin? Is this going to, you know, really get reflected in, you know, the exchanges as the choke point? I mean, there's a world where Bitcoin goes back to being that unit of account, right? Like, you know, in the pre-times, Bitcoin was, you know, all coins were basically priced in Bitcoin. There weren't really dollar pairs. Maybe it goes back to that, and Bitcoin's a beneficiary here. You know, I think a lot of this is self-inflicted. And if you're really loose on enforcement, people take advantage of that. Like, you had scammers that just had sort of like, you know, taking the cookie off the shelf. And there was really nobody doing anything to stop them, no matter how egregious it was. So now maybe that changes, but, you know, we'll see.
As a follow on to that, how much more, listen, I'm almost sick of the kind of contagion narrative, although it's not false. And we're still seeing, you know, a lot of the legal side of this has a ways to play out. And, you know, the Celsius and DCG and Gemini, Genesis, you know, Block, there's a lot left to on the adjudication side and to really figure out like who's going to get paid by whom and where people are stacking up in the creditor lists. But is there more bad news to come, or are we just in the like seeing it play out phase?
There's definitely a lot of bad debt to get worked through. You know, if we're talking about the price of Bitcoin, I would love to think about it in terms of like, who are the forced sellers here that have lots of Bitcoin that haven't already liquidated? Like, who still is out there that, you know, may end up just dumping a tremendous amount on the market? Like, miners already have. Right. Like, you know, Bitcoin's one of the most liquid assets that they can convert in a bankruptcy event, like to begin with. Like, that's been liquidated. Like, you know, who else is out there that could be another like really, you know, big slug of forced liquidations?
Do you have a thought on who it is, or is there?
I look, this is Bitcoin, so what? Nobody knows anything. I don't know anything. I think that they're exhausted. I think that, you know, for the most part, a lot of that has already been worked through the system. I do still think that there is a lot of bad debt to work through for, let's say, like ASIC lenders, right? You know, the big shops that are out there, like, you know, Galaxy, NYDIG, Foundry, Anchorage, BlockFi, rest in peace, Celsius, rest in peace. Like, but those big ASIC lenders still have, I think, stuff to work through. But I just don't think there's a lot of Bitcoin in the mix there. I think that the miners or the borrowers who are either in default or heading for default probably don't have much Bitcoin. And then, you know, in the fund world, like, you know, I think that hopefully we've seen the worst of that. I don't know if there's another Alameda or somebody that's just, you know, gonna vomit.
If there was, I think to answer your question on that, it probably would be DCG if there was Bitcoin to be liquidated. But it seems like they've reached an agreement, at least for now, those three, Genesis, DCG, and Gemini. But yeah, that's a good question indeed. Who still needs to sell?
Well, and you see it like, all right, so all the technical people out there are going to get upset. But, you know, one kind of like anecdotal indicator is people just stop selling on bad news at a certain point in a bear market because there's exhaustion, right? And you see the kind of like, I forget what the indicator is that, you know, shows the basically the unmoved coins, right? The UTXOs that have aged. And so that number goes up and then, you know, people just get sick of the bad news cycle and you kind of hit this like lull, right? And it does seem like the news cycle is not driving price as much as it was a year ago or even 6 months ago. And we've seen this every time, right? Just people just kind of get bored of the drama. And then we start, you know, moving in the next direction. So I don't know. That's kind of what it feels like to me. But I'm sure someone's going to like pull up a chart and tell me I'm wrong.
No, I totally agree. The HODL waves look good. Less Bitcoin on exchanges. I think people are more sensitive to counterparty risk than they really ever have been. You know, there's a lot to be excited about. What are we, 18 months out from a halving? Like, you know, yeah. We got NFTs on the Bitcoin blockchain.
We're probably 14 months out from a halving.
Yeah, those rewards are getting small.
We need those fees.
Yeah, that's right.
But look, I think miners, from what I've been seeing, you know, we've started to see a little bit of a shift, right? Miners that are able to survive this are now looking at really cheap, you know, ASICs on the secondary market. And, you know, there are some quality projects that probably can be acquired out there. And the mining economics, they go through this. There is this, you know, crushing cycle. But I think we're, you know, hopefully starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel for this liquidation flush phase. And then you're in that reset as you get closer to the halving.
So do you see, though, like the sort of cyclical strong, the strong will survive that consolidates or it gives the folks that have balance sheets to go out and acquire things the ability to consolidate? Where's the other side of that where, you know, we get some more venture funding, some more kind of like green shoots into the new projects and the new entities? Because right now it just seems like consolidation and either you're going out of business or being acquired. Do you see kind of a new cycle on the innovation side coming?
Yeah, for sure. I think that people from the energy industry are starting to realize just the sheer abundance of wasted or stranded energy sources. There's a lot of really, you know, interesting projects that are trying to raise at like the absolute worst time given market conditions. Like, you know, a lot of the fund and capital formation aspects, particularly for mining operations, it's excruciating. Like, these debt facilities are closed for a while. Selling equity is not the most attractive for a mining operation. So, you know, one of the things that we work on Hash Function is the ability to sell production forward, which is how, you know, energy exploration and precious metal mines finance their operations, you know, anyway. That just has to come to Bitcoin. But this is a much longer conversation around, you know, the difficulties in pricing hash rate and structuring these, you know, offtakes and streaming agreements, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I think we are starting to see a lot of innovation, and the big guys get bigger if they're able to. Like, I don't think anybody's super healthy in the mining space right now, but some of them are doing okay. Some of them had, you know, the right, you know, timing and the right risk management when things were getting crazy in the ASIC acquisition market in like 2021. But, you know, we'll see newcomers that, you know, pop up. And one of the things that makes Bitcoin mining such an awful business is you got a lot of people that are not mining for dollar profits, right? You got hobbyists that like mining in the basement. You got, you know, people that want access, like anonymous access or just access in general to, you know, a different type of financial protocol, value protocol, whatever. So, you know, if you're a public miner or somebody like that competing against, you know, whether it's a nation state looking for access or just hobbyists in a basement, that's dilutive hash rate that you're competing against. And that's a difficult place to be. And I think we're seeing much more of that over the last like 2 years.
Yeah, that's interesting. General question there on, I guess, from the perspective of HODL Capital, your investing thesis in the market today, how much headspace does mining take up for you? Because obviously you're involved in mining too, with everything, you know, you're doing with Hash Function and just being involved in the industry. How much consideration do you give to the mining market as far as like your overall investment thesis? Or I don't know, do you ever completely exit Bitcoin and go to dollars because of mining, things going on in the mining industry or anything like that?
Mining is fascinating. Like it's much more of like, you know, the long-term value proposition of Bitcoin, I think, trumps it. But, you know, the way I think about a mining operation, you know, everything on the cost side is denominated in dollars. Everything on the revenue side is denominated in either Bitcoin or hash price.
Yep.
And if you're generating, you know, a stream of hash rate, it's a good dollar cost average acquisition strategy, right? You're getting the economics of a mining operation, you know, not always, but usually able to generate Bitcoin at a discount to whatever it's trading at spot. That's the whole, you know, thesis or, you know, profit generation for the business, the entire industry. So it usually has to be true. It's a good like long-term strategy. You have to, you know, there are people that convert out and they don't really have a core Bitcoin thesis. I have cheap energy. I can, you know, do this to get dollars. It's a lot easier if you have a core conviction in the staying power of Bitcoin as an asset, and something that will hold its value over a long term. And I think it's a combination of the two. So, you know, HODL Capital is crystallized. All the activity is hash function now. And I think that we have those two things, right? We have sort of a view towards, you know, real Bitcoin yield plays, you know, this concept of streaming physical delivery, you know, a contract that de-risks over the life of the contract, you know, are fascinating. And it's a great way to build a Bitcoin treasury, which I think is still the core goal of the company.
I'm going to have to hop to reality shortly, but first of all, Thomas, thank you. Fantastic to connect with you. But was there anything you wanted to get into, stuff that is interesting, or you want to let people know is going on?
No, this was great. Thank you very, very much for having me on. Come check us out at PubKey. Come grab an orange pill. We're opening a co-working space above the bar, you know, probably next month. If anybody's interested in doing anything, you know, related to Bitcoin, think of PubKey as sort of a blank canvas. We're down for all sorts of, you know, collaborations and Bitcoin-related events or use cases or whatever.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, I love the idea, man. It's congratulations on getting that up and running, and wish you guys all the best. Hope you guys have a lot of success there. I'm sure you will. And as you said, revamping the scene down there in New York. And any other links? Any other final comments?
No, that's it. I hope, you know, next time there's a honey badger, maybe a PubKey pop-up in Riga. That's my goal.
I'll be there for sure. But definitely, I think... before the halving, for sure, I got to get back in New York, so catch up there.
Cool. Be good to see you. Thank you very much, guys. Have fun.
Awesome, Thomas.